Chapter 7. Their Cages. June 16, 2018. Juan was locked up in a federal prison in Victorville. By common consensus, it was a hellhole. No sign of attorneys, no access to phones, horrendous food, dirty conditions, and worst of all, not a word from his son, Jose, who by now was in Texas, thousands of miles from where they had been separated in Arizona. There was no information about Jose and Juan's case file, meaning they couldn't be connected even if he wanted to be. The same day, I traveled home from South Texas with Arnie, looking out the window at Brownsville as we flew away, landing in Dallas for our connection home to Los Angeles as the sun was setting. Meanwhile, Lindsay Toslowski was trying to get into Victorville to see the new migrant detainees. I didn't know her, but Toslowski lived in the same neighborhood I did in Los Angeles, with children slightly older than my son. The executive director of Immigrant Defenders Law Center, a nonprofit law firm offering legal defense for migrants and refugees, she had spent her career defending people like Juan and his son Jose against deportation. Every time I looked down at my phone, new reports from around the world highlighted what I and the other journalists had seen firsthand. What the reality of family separations looked like for young boys. It only compounded how anxious I was to get home to see my wife and son. For her part, Toslowski was desperate to get inside the federal prison she had heard was now home to an increasing population of migrants, including separated parents. She called three times on June 11th in order to figure out what the guidelines were for entering the facility, but the phone kept ringing and ringing. Nobody picked up. The following morning, after dropping her kids at daycare, she made the drive from Los Angeles to the prison and asked to meet with detainees to offer free legal services, including Juan, whose name was on a leaked list of incarcerated migrants she had obtained. She was turned away twice, first by an officer who told her he didn't know how those types of visits would work, since most of the men locked up were convicts, not facing civil immigration charges. Then she was told by another prison official that there was an across-the-board visitation ban because there wasn't space available and Immigration and Customs Enforcement hadn't given the go-ahead for them to take place. After handing over her list of detainees, Toslowski was told she would hear from ICE. Dejected and physically intimidated, she got back in her car and returned to Los Angeles, not knowing what to believe. What she did grasp was that the rights of those detained inside were being violated. Two nights later, Thursday evening, she went to sleep hoping that the formal visitation request submitted that day would gain her access. Friday passed, and she received no response. On the same day, I spent hours broadcasting from outside Casa Padre, breaking the news that the federal government was standing up the Tornillo tent camp for migrant children. Attorney General Jeff Sessions used the Bible to justify separating children. He aimed to push back on one of many critical statements leveled at him and the administration, this one by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which correctly observed that, quote, "our government has the discretion in our laws to ensure that young children are not separated from their parents and exposed to irreparable harm and trauma." The Conference of Bishops added, "Families are the foundational element of our society, and they must be able to stay together." Standing behind the seal of the United States Department of Justice, Sessions had the temerity to tell an audience made up of Rotary Club members in Fort Wayne, Indiana, that, quote, "many of the criticisms raised in recent days are not fair or logical, and some are contrary to the law." The audience sat silently. He continued, evoking, quote, "the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13, to obey the laws of government because God has ordained them for the purpose of order. Orderly and lawful processes are good in themselves and protect the weak and the lawful. Our policies that can result in short-term separation of families is not unusual or unjustified." The Fort Wayne Rotarians, for their part, regretted participation in Sessions' speech, posting online, "we have instituted policies to never allow it to happen again." Also on that Thursday, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, from the briefing room in the West Wing, played verbal gymnastics with the assembled press corps, who pressed her on separations. She insisted, "It's not a policy change to enforce the law," when, indeed, in early May, Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen had signed the still-secret secretarial memo, putting the nationwide separation policy into place. That night, I finally arrived home late after connecting through Dallas. Our plane landed at Los Angeles International Airport just before midnight, and by the time I got home, my son was already in his crib sleeping, and my wife was long passed out. As I joined my wife in bed, I thought about the boys who, as of 9 p.m. Brownsville time, were sitting in their bedrooms inside the former Walmart known as Casa Padre. "Night," I said to my wife, planting a kiss on her head. Before the sun came up the following morning, I was at my desk in the small office we kept off our kitchen. With the TV on next to my desk tuned to MSNBC, anchor Stephanie Ruhle started her broadcast with some tape playback of President Trump, who had just done an interview on Fox and Friends, his favorite and friendly morning program. She interrupted the playback as the three familiar notes of the NBC jingle played and the breaking news banner whooshed across the screen. "President Trump's taking questions right now on the lawn," Ruhle said. "Let's listen in." At 3 minutes after 9 in the morning, he started chatting up the White House press corps en route back to the West Wing. With jockeying journalists surrounding him, he was peppered with questions about the Mueller investigation, Kim Jong-un, and pardons for his former campaign associates. Finally, President Trump stretched out his left hand, pointing at a journalist behind the frontline scrum of cameras, who asked him about the story that had dominated our airwaves for 24 hours. "Mr. President, do you agree with children being taken away from—" "No, I hate it. I hate the children being taken away. The Democrats have to change their law. That's their law. They will force—" The president stopped short, interrupted by a follow-up question. "Sir, that's your own policy. That's your own policy. Why do you keep lying about it, sir?" "Quiet, quiet. That's the Democrats' law," President Trump said, indeed lying. President Trump, the White House, and cabinet members were all parroting some version of the same line Nielsen herself served me when we sat down in the basement of the Reagan building just over a month earlier. "It's not different," she told me then. After I heard the president, something in me snapped, born from the frustration of hearing the commander-in-chief say something I knew personally not to be true. For a moment, I thought about holding my fire, thinking about what executives back at 30 Rock might say or do, but what I saw had left an indelible mark. Moreover, I had borne witness to facts that were contrary to what the Trump administration, including the president himself, was insisting. 11 minutes after Stephanie Ruhle signed off the air, and just a little bit longer after the president walked off the White House lawn, I opened Twitter on my phone and decided to tweet. "Since we toured the Brownsville border shelter, Trump, Sessions, and Sanders have all lied about what's happening there. Overcrowding is a crisis manufactured by Trump, a direct result of new policy to prosecute 100% of people who enter the U.S. illegally, which separates families." That night, my wife and I went to dinner for our 6th anniversary, delayed a day because of the reporting trip. Lindsay Tislowski was still waiting for any word from the Bureau of Prisons about when she would be able to see the migrants locked inside Victorville. The following morning, I joined Joy Reid on her Saturday program. "It's complete BS," I said, "to hear the president, the attorney general, Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying there's nothing new about this. There's nothing unusual, or it's the Democrats' policy. This has never, ever been done before as a systematic policy to take kids away from their parents at the rate of 100% is the goal of the Trump administration as a matter of immigration policy." Again, in my head, I briefly paused, thinking about the consequences of giving my opinion instead of directly sharing by reporting, but what I had seen was too important to make it about some kind of neutral take. "It's just never been done before. It's reminiscent of Native American children being taken away from their parents or children separated from their families at Japanese internment camps. This is not an immigration policy that we have seen before from the federal government." Later that day, my wife and I took our son to a birthday party at a local elementary school around the corner from our house. It was walking distance, and along the way, my phone buzzed. Katie Waldman, The press aide to Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen was calling again. Enjoying the afternoon with my family, I hesitated in picking up the call, but I ultimately did. "Where are you?" Waldman asked me. "Home, walking with my wife and son to a birthday party," I told her. "What's up?" "Can you get to McAllen tomorrow?" "Tomorrow? But tomorrow's Father's Day." "Why?" "We're letting journalists into the CPC, Border Patrol lingo for the Central Processing Center. This is the epicenter," she said.
"The epicenter?"
"Of separations." I let out a deep exhale. The congressional delegation would be visiting tomorrow afternoon, she explained. The tour she was offering me would happen before, first thing in the morning. "I'm not even sure I can get there," I said, looking at the time. I told Waldman I would call her back. I quickly explained to my wife what was going on and shot a text to Janelle Rodriguez, my boss. It was nearly Saturday evening in New York, and I had no idea if she'd even be available to talk. Just in case, I called Arnie, too, and told him about the access we had just been offered. "Hey, man, what's up?" he asked when he picked up the call. "If we can get to McAllen by tomorrow morning, we can get inside the place they're separating most of the kids on the border. Just messaged Janelle. No word back." "Okay, I'll start looking at flights and for a local crew," he said without skipping a beat. We hung up, and I, too, started checking out travel options. It wasn't looking good. There are no direct flights from Los Angeles to McAllen. It takes at least one connection to make it to the tiny airport. It's the same one from which Customs and Border Protection launches its aircraft in the area, including the Black Hawk chopper we rode in that April. The family we saw surrendering to the Border Patrol from our sky-high vantage point back then could very well be among the ranks of the separated now. Time running out, the only flight that seemed like it might work was an American Airlines red-eye that left early on Sunday morning connecting through Dallas. By that time, I was sitting in the parking lot of the local elementary school where parents throwing the birthday party had hired a miniature train to drive in circles in the parking lot and take kids for a whirl. My son loved trains, so we didn't even make it all the way into the party before jumping on. After one loop around the parking lot, my phone rang again. I told my wife and son I had to jump off and walked out of the parking lot and onto the street in front of the school. It was Janelle calling back, and she was unequivocal. "Let's do it." I had to go back in and break it to my wife. She was completely understanding, and I told her I would have to leave the party, too, to go pack. I kissed her and my little man goodbye. As I walked home, I let Katie Waldman know I would be there first thing tomorrow and to ask for details. Just days after I left, I was heading back to South Texas. June 17th, 2018. Father's Day in the United States is always observed on the third Sunday in June. In Guatemala, it's always observed on the 17th day of June. This year, the holiday happened to coincide in the United States. Juan spent the day locked up in federal prison in Victorville, while his 14-year-old son was thousands of miles apart in a shelter for migrant children in Harlingen, Texas. Maria, Juan's wife and Jose's mother, hadn't heard from either of them for 13 days, since the day they were planning on crossing the border into the United States. At 12:59 a.m. on that Sunday, my wife and son were asleep as Arnie and I took off to Dallas. We touched down before sunrise. Arnie and I transferred to a small commuter plane, launched into the Texas sky, and around 10:30 landed in McAllen. Within an hour, I would be inside, in the words of Katie Waldman, the epicenter of family separations. Just before 11:30 a.m. in McAllen, I appeared on air, still in the same pants and red socks I had on when I left Los Angeles. Watching the TV on Father's Day morning, my son slapped himself on the mouth while staring up at me on the screen. I was reporting from a conference room inside the Border Patrol Processing Center, awaiting a press conference from Manuel Manny Padilla, the chief of the Border Patrol's Rio Grande Valley sector. "Dada!" little Noah screamed. He turned around and looked at my wife, who had pulled out her phone to film him, his bushy, dirty blonde mop of hair swinging as he did. He was, I'm ashamed to admit, used to talking to me through a screen, FaceTime becoming a constant while I was away on one reporting trip or another. "Dada?" "Huh?" he asked with the sounds he could muster. Then he walked closer to the TV, stretching up on his tiptoes to reach his hands up behind it, as if I were hiding on the other side, his diaper popping out of his striped purple pajamas. Children my son's age had been taken from their parents and kept inside the building I was about to tour. Chief Padilla, the Border Patrol official we were about to hear from, had told the Washington Post they stopped separating children under 5 years old by now. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan had reportedly given the order to stop the separation of such young children amid what he told others became his own crisis of conscience about the policy, a policy he urged Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen to adopt, the same policy that was discussed at a meeting convened in his conference room at a Valentine's Day meeting less than a month after President Trump was inaugurated. In my hand was the little blue spiral notebook I had bought 4 days earlier on my way to see the hundreds of separated boys in Brownsville. Those boys may very well have passed through and been separated from their families in the facility I was now standing in, before being sent on to Casa Padre, or Harlingen, where Jose was in custody, or any of the dozens of others of shelters throughout the country. It's not something that needs to be happening right now, I told anchor Alex Witt back in New York about family separations. It's something that the Trump administration decided they wanted to be happening. Contrary to what the president and Jeff Sessions and Sarah Huckabee Sanders have said, they have said it is a Democratic law. That is not true. The attorney general said that this is not unusual to separate children like this. I stopped as Chief Padilla walked into the room. Here is Chief Padilla, I told Witt. The start of the press conference was carried live. After a lengthy introduction, Padilla got to the topic the dozens of assembled journalists were there to see themselves, backing up the point I had just made on TV. I think everybody is aware that the Attorney General signed the executive order, or the order, Padilla corrected himself, saying, on April 6th. DHS Secretary signed the implementation guidance May 5th of 2018. So Border Patrol, he said, turning to his agency's role in the policy, we implement that guidance. We are the implementers of that guidance. What that meant in practice, he told us, was that 1,174 kids had been taken from their parents since separations began under zero tolerance. 711 of those children were transferred to shelters like Casa Padre, where I was days earlier. Padilla was peppered with questions. I asked whether any children under five had been separated in his custody. He said no. CBS's David Begno inquired where girls were being held. He explained that all separated children went to ORR custody. And another reporter pressed him on whether he would stop separations if a court halted the policy. He said he'd have to talk with his lawyers. All right, folks, interrupted Robert Rodriguez, the public information officer detailed to the Rio Grande Valley sector, and whom I had gotten to know while working on our Dateline documentary. From this side of the room, this way, he said, pointing to the area I was standing, y'all are going to be taken out to the CPC, the Central Processing Center, where migrants were detained. As a reminder, folks, visitors shall not bring any electronic or recording devices, cameras, laptops, or wireless communications devices, such as smartphones or mobile phones. We shall not have any physical or verbal contact with the detainees without the consent of CBP. That refrain was becoming a familiar one to me. After Rodriguez finished, I approached Padilla, who was still at the podium getting ready to deliver the same press conference in Spanish, to ask him how long he thought it might take to get to 100% prosecutions, since he had just mentioned only 40% of the families were being separated at this point, approximately the same figure I had heard from Dr. Sanchez at Casa Padre. It changes, because if the strength starts going down, we'll get there quicker, he said of the flow of migrants crossing the border. So basically, I replied, it depends on if the deterrence is working. Padilla nodded and flashed me a thumbs up. Following orders, I took off the lavalier microphone I was wearing and gave it back to our crew and headed out of the conference room and down the hallway where we would meet our guides, Carmen Qualia, Assistant Chief Patrol Agent in the Rio Grande Valley sector, and John Lopez, the Acting Deputy Patrol Agent in charge, both like Padilla and Rodriguez, dressed in their green Border Patrol uniforms. I was shocked to discover that only steps from where we were standing during Padilla's press conference was the door to the processing center. We were told the facility was just over 75,000 square feet. The first portion we would walk through, around 22,000 square feet, was for single adults. Padilla had warned us the area would be busy. It is where intake is occurring, properties being confiscated, and medical screenings take place. And he was right. When we walked through the door, men were crowded inside cells, some flashing thumbs up while others clung silently to silver Mylar blankets meant to keep them warm. Several shouted to get the attention of the reporters, reminding me again of other jail tours I had been on. Cell 18 was labeled, "Do Not Use." There was a woman inside. Another migrant spit as we walked past. The occupant of cell 17 muttered, "Mucho frío," very cold. We were moved quickly through this side of the facility. When we entered the other portion of the processing center, a former warehouse converted into a holding pen for, at that very moment, 1,129 humans, it was much, much quieter. This, we were told, was where we would see children separated from their parents in 2 of 4 pods in Border Patrol lingo. To anyone else, they'd be called cages. As we approached the enclosures, chain-link fences on all sides, twice as tall as I was, my first thought was dog kennels. The big kind you might see in a boarding facility or in back at a veterinarian's office. But inside were children. In front of us were boys 17 and under, the same age group I saw the week before at Casa Padre. We asked how the children, currently lying on green mats atop concrete floors and under Mylar blankets, as they were supervised by a security contractor in a watchtower, made it from here to there. ICE is the conduit for ORR to get them to the facilities, Agent Lopez told us in front of another cage filled with humans. These are family units, male head of household, he continued, responding to another question as he pointed to the fathers and children who were kept together. Not far away were cages with young girls, alone, and another with children and their mothers. 4 pods total holding 525 members of families together, and another one with 179 children who had either arrived alone or were separated from their parents. Other than the occasional high-pitched voice of a child or the crinkling of the Mylar blankets, it continued to strike me how the volume differed in this area of the processing center. It was as if the people here knew that talking at this point wouldn't help. I kept scribbling notes in my little blue spiral book as Agent Lopez stood in between us and the migrants locked inside. I asked Agent Lopez if there were social workers here, and he admitted there were only 4 for the hundreds of children. We requested to speak with them. The answer was, again, no. Another reporter in Spanish snuck a question to a caged woman who told us she wasn't aware of separations happening, likely meaning she had not yet had her case processed by agents or had arrived with a child younger than 5. Migrants were being told of the policy only if they were involved in a separation. Then they were given an informational tear sheet, which explained in English and Spanish that they were about to be charged with a crime and their child would be moved to the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where they could find them by dialing a phone number. The tear sheet only recently had been added to the process on the orders of CBP Commissioner McAleenan, meaning hundreds if not thousands previously went through the process without that information. Another mother told us that even if a parent was charged and sentenced to time served, meaning they were free to come back to pick up their children, there was a possibility that children would have already been moved out to an ORR shelter and were now in the custody of the federal government for the foreseeable future. This, and separations, were happening more in the facility we were standing in than anywhere else along the entire border. We asked how long children would be here after their parents were taken away. The answer was that facilities like Casa Padre and the Office of Refugee Resettlement needed to be notified within 24 hours if a child is separated and left alone, rendered unaccompanied. with only 10 permanent processing agents, that was making things difficult. Our tour was now stretching multiples longer than the scheduled 7 minutes. Finally, the agents began escorting us out. "We're strained and struggling," Agent Lopez admitted to me around that time. As we passed back through the processing area, he showed me what he meant. They did not have enough agents to deal with the practice of separations, something they had never done on this scale before. To account for the unprecedented workload, virtual processing was being employed. Seated at computer screens, some separated parents were being processed by agents in another Border Patrol facility, El Paso, El Centro, or Corpus Christi, over video conference. An impersonal touch to an inhumane process. As we were escorted back out to the lockers where we left our electronic devices, we were told we would receive approved footage shot by Customs and Border Protection, images and video, while we were inside. But waiting for the media to come through wasn't an option. As soon as I walked out of the red-roofed Border Patrol building that was attached to the warehouse, I crossed Ursula Street and stood on the street corner where Arnie and the crew had set up our live shot location while I was inside. David Gura was in the middle of anchoring the 2 o'clock afternoon hour on MSNBC. At 46 minutes after the hour, he broke back from commercial, announcing I was about to present breaking news, describing what I saw inside. "Jacob," Gura began, "I remember your vivid descriptions of the children's center you visited a couple days ago. What'd you see today?" "Whereas at the other detention center, which is actually a shelter run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, there were 1,400 young boys between the ages of 10 and 17. There were no cages, there were no fences. That's what there is inside of here. Everybody is inside, effectively, very large cells with multiple people." I continued with Gura until we ran into technical difficulties, but rejoined him the next hour, this time with Dr. Colleen Kraft, the head of the American Academy of Pediatrics, who in May, when the zero-tolerance policy was announced, wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times. Kraft had eviscerated the policy on the grounds that the damage it would inflict on children would never be reversed. Studies overwhelmingly demonstrate the irreparable harm caused by breaking up families. Prolonged exposure to highly stressful situations, known as toxic stress, can disrupt a child's brain architecture and affect his or her short and long-term health. A parent or a known caregiver's role is to mitigate these dangers. When robbed of that buffer, children are susceptible to learning deficits and chronic conditions such as depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and even heart disease. The government's practice of separating children from their parents at the border counteracts every science-based recommendation I have ever made to families who seek to build and not harm their children's intellectual and emotional development. The same day I had gone inside Casa Padre, Dr. Kraft had given an interview to CNN, in which she had called the zero-tolerance policy government-sanctioned child abuse. Her words caught the attention of one of the world's most famous people, though she had missed the call and only received a surprising voicemail. "Hello, Dr. Kraft," the message ran. "Oprah Winfrey calling. I'm calling regarding the article I saw on CNN regarding the children and immigration. I wanted to talk to you, and I was struck by something that you said about it being government-sanctioned child abuse. So I want to have a conversation with you about what we can do. I feel so, you know, I don't want to be hopeless about it, but it is so disturbing to me. So I'm going to be traveling for the next few hours. I do have your cell number. This is your cell number. So I will try to reach you tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you very much." Now on air in a double box with me, Dr. Kraft continued to sound the alarm for my hometown of Los Angeles, her blue suit jacket a slightly darker shade than the fake skyline behind her, her red hair framed by 2 hanging pearl earrings. "We have to speak out about it. Talk about the right policy, which is keeping kids and families together. Our children have a limited amount of time to grow and develop. We have to give them the best start we can." I appeared on our air several more times that afternoon and evening, ending the day with Casey Hunt, who was anchoring her program from Washington. "This is the first time ever the children have been separated on a systematic basis. Look at those photos right there," I said to Casey, pointing to the monitor in front of me where the handout images I had been waiting for were now on screen, children lying on the green mats under Mylar blankets I had walked by earlier, mothers lined up single file, some with children, some without. The wind started to pick up, blowing not just the palm trees that framed the Border Patrol station behind me, but my hair and microphone. From their parents. And that is because of the Trump administration. People in here are locked up in cages, essentially what look like animal kennels. I don't know any other way to describe it. And strangely, the Washington Post gave Senator Jeff Merkley what they call three Pinocchios for saying kids are locked up in cages, and that is exactly what I saw today. An hour and 45 minutes later, the Post published an op-ed by former First Lady Laura Bush. In a tweet, she shared the piece with her followers, writing, "I live in a border state. I appreciate the need to enforce and protect our international boundaries, but this zero-tolerance policy is cruel. It is immoral, and it breaks my heart." Bush, too, pointed to the words of Dr. Kraft to rally the nation against the separation policy. Recently, Colleen Kraft, who heads the American Academy of Pediatrics, visited a shelter run by the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement. She reported that while there were beds, toys, crayons, a playground, and diaper changes, the people working at the shelter had been instructed not to pick up or touch the children to comfort them. Imagine not being able to pick up a child who is not yet out of diapers. Bush concluded there had to be another way, and the policy must be ended. In 2018, can we not, as a nation, find a kinder, more compassionate, and more moral answer to this current crisis? I, for one, believe we can. She was not alone. The following morning, her successor as First Lady, Michelle Obama, retweeted Bush's article despite the fact that to address an unprecedented flow of families crossing the border during his second term, her husband's administration built the facility in which separated children were caged. "Sometimes truth transcends party," she tweeted. The numbers were staggering. Between May 5th and June 9th, more than 2,300 children had been taken from their parents, more separated in a month than the entire previous year. As Commander Jonathan White and statisticians at the Department of Homeland Security projected, there was not enough bed space for all of the children coming to ORR. Father's Day over, and the work week beginning, the challenge was to keep the pressure on the administration to end the policy with so many separations happening so quickly. With President Trump specializing in the art of the deflection and gaslighting, this promised to be a difficult task. He was backed up by a cadre of officials who had carefully considered family separations since the first days of his administration. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, and inside his own White House had been made aware of the likely disastrous aftermath those separated would have to endure. Trauma. Difficulty reuniting. Potential permanent separations. But none of that stopped the woman in charge of the Border Patrol agents doing the separating from denying what I, and now the entire nation, was seeing happening. Earlier that day, President Trump's Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, often the subject of the president's scorn and abusive behavior, tweeted a doozy she must have figured would please the tweeter-in-chief. "We do not have a policy of separating families at the border, period." My eyes widened when I saw it. You've got to be kidding, I thought. Come on. Not far from where more family separations were happening than anywhere else along the border, I decided to reply to her tweet with one of my own. Three facepalm emojis of a guy slapping his visage in disbelief. What on the one hand felt like a childish response also felt somewhat perfect given the circumstances. And if Nielsen's tweet seemed like peak lying, it was only the start of the deflection, deceit, and dishonesty to come. From Lloyd Scott, ACF. Sent Friday, June 22nd, 2018, 11:43 a.m. 2. Wagner, Stephen, ACF. Wynn, Maggie, HHS, IOS. Harrison, Brian, HHS, IOS. Urbanowitz, Peter, HHS, IOS. Cadillac, Robert, OS. Asper, IO. Subject: Update. Importance: High. We have two categories of separated kids, one from the beginning of the fiscal year, the other from May 6th, the beginning of zero tolerance. CBP chiefs started separations before the announcement of the zero policy, and we noticed it and started tracking. As of June 18th, we've received 1,911 UACs from zero tolerance, May 6th. Of them, 114 were discharged.